This is Deanna Spingola. It is Saturday, September 8th, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Richard Wilcox. He lives in Tokyo, and this is our second interview that we've had. And I think it's very important that we keep up to date with what is going on over there. So welcome to the program, Richard.
Thank you very much for having me on your program.
Well, you have quite a lot of articles. You have some at environmentalarmageddon.wordpress.com. And I will be sure and post all of these. Well, you have a lot of them there. And then you have one on rents. Which talks about the doomed planet for a failed species. And then you have one at JapanClubCulture.com talking about the nuclear mafia derails democracy, which is basically some of the same things that you said on rants. But you really are very prolific in getting all of this information out, and I really appreciate it. You being on the program to talk about it here. And I know that it's Sunday morning where you're at, and it's Saturday evening where I am. So it was kind of impossible to have you on the regular RBN program because of the time difference. It would have been something like, what, 2 o'clock in the morning for you or 3 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah, that's right. We did try that even a long time ago, but it was, from my point of view, tricky. So this works out really well. Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. That's why I started doing these specials, so I could have the pleasure of talking with people who live in different time zones but who had something very important to say.
That's right. And I remember you had this New Zealand guy on once. It's funny. I heard he's actually suing Sea Shepherd just off the top of my head. That was funny because I haven't followed that story, but he was the guy that got arrested by the Japanese, and he was in Japanese prison, and now he's had a falling out with Sea Shepherd. So I don't know if you heard about that, but
he's
all the way across the world too.
yeah, and people in Australia. I mean, it's something like 14-hour time difference. So
yeah. So anyway, the situation at Fukushima is not good. Arnie Gunderson came to Japan recently, and he talked to Tokyo Electric, and he asked them, this is a latest little article from the Japan Times quoted, and I know people don't go around thinking about all these technical aspects of the nuclear power situation, but I think everybody listening to this program is, I know that they're all very intelligent people, and so they follow to some extent the basics of the nuclear situation. And so you have these fuel pools with spent fuel from the reactors sitting in basically a big swimming pool, and it's above ground. And if there was an earthquake, the one that's been well publicized on the alternative media is the Unit 4 fuel pool. And if an earthquake happened, it could crack or knock over that fuel pool, causing a fire in the, as the water escaped, the rods, the fuel rods would get so hot they would burn, cause a radiological fire that would release massive amounts of radiation, according to some experts like Robert Alvarez or Arnie Gunderson and so on.
Okay, now he's the chief engineer of energy consultant company Fairwinds, is that right?
Yeah, Alvarez is
or Gunderson.
I can't remember about him, but yeah, Gunderson is Fairwinds, right? And so he's so well known, among people because he was, he's such an articulate spokesperson for the, he knows all the technical aspects.
Right.
And he explains those so well to laypersons like us. But yes, Fairwinds, and he used to be a nuclear engineer and so on. FAIREWINDS.com.
Right.
You got to put the E in there.
Yeah, it's kind of funny the way it's spelled, but yes.
Yeah. So, I kind of just jumped right into this topic because it's kind of interesting. Because, so you got this fuel pool sitting there, and Arnie Gunderson asked the Tokyo Electric, and he had a very competent interpreter, translator person with him at the time. And he said, I told TEPCO that I realized they hoped and believed that there would always be water in the nuclear fuel pool. I had to ask whether or not they had prepared chemicals to put out a nuclear fuel pool fire in case of an emergency. And their response was, there's nothing in the fuel pool that can burn. And he said, I find that appalling. And I say, I find that absurd, because what are they talking about?
Yes, indeed.
You follow my story?
Yes.
Yeah, it's so crazy. In other words, they're in total denial. And I mean, and the reason I tell this story is because it represents the level of incompetence, or I don't know what word to use, arrogance or stupidity or insanity or denial that the nuclear industry is in. It's not only a Japanese problem, but it seems like there is some kind of Japanese mentality associated with such an absurd statement to say that they're not even worried about a fuel fire.
Well,
but,
are they saying that to try to assure the public that they don't have anything to worry about, or why?
Yeah.
Why would anybody say that?
Yeah, they're saying that because they don't want to spend the money to deal with the situation properly. And they don't want anybody sticking their nose in their situation. They say they're consulting with the IAEA, but Arnie says the IAEA is inside the box thinking. And I mean, they're basically doing nothing. And what he and other engineers are saying is that they need to think outside the box, go around the world, get the best minds together so that they can deal with this horrendous situation at Fukushima. You know, this is a special situation. And TEPCO, yeah.
Doesn't it sort of remind you of the BP oil spill?
Yes.
When this was a very similar situation. And so what did they do? Instead of listening to the best minds and the best ideas for actually soaking up all of this oil and whatnot that would have been done naturally, they used poison. How stupid is that? And it seems to be the same kind of mentality.
It is. It is a good analogy, and I think I used that analogy in one of my papers. And that's exactly right. It's this technocentric mentality, or engineer geek kind of way of thinking, instead of holistic versus holistic or naturalistic way of approaching things. So we see it, two paradigms crashing together here.
Right.
Of people who want to live simply. And, you know, the alternative media is full of one thing. I'm really happy to be part of Activist Post, because they've been real friendly to me and supportive. They published a lot of my articles, so, and they're archived there as well, Activist Post. But they have so many good articles, for example, about GMOs or poisons in foods and all these sorts of things. So it's not only radiation or oil spills. All of these technological disasters are happening at the same time, and it's attacking us all at once, and it's just something we have to wake up about.
Certainly.
Yeah.
And
so
you mentioned the kamikaze mentality, kamikaze pilots.
Right.
and here they... You know, that's how they were. In fact, I'm reading a book right now about the prisoners in Japan.
Wow.
And it's kind of an interesting book, you know, dealing with World War II.
Yeah.
And they don't seem to be living in reality. I mean, it's like, okay, we'll do what we do, and they never think about the consequences of, okay, what about after the war when all this becomes revealed? Because they I don't know. It's just kind of a crazy, like you say, a kamikaze mentality.
Your book is about the Japanese holding foreign prisoners of war, or?
Yeah, it's a book. It's called Prisoners of the Japanese.
Ah.
And it talks about
Were they treated brutally? Were the prisoners?
Oh my word. Oh my
Right.
word. Yes. And you would think, okay, the small country has ha they have all these people from Britain, from Australia, all these prisoners from
Right.
all of the South Eastern or not Southeastern from the South East Asia countries. And don't they think, do they actually think they're going to win the war? And everything's going to be okay? And I see them thinking the same way with this Fukushima thing.
Yeah, that's funny. I have a good friend and we discuss these kind of issues. And we were just, we always wonder about why did they attack Pearl Harbor? And I know all about Roosevelt luring Japan into World War II, and Japan was cornered, and absolutely the World War II is told written by the history is written by the victors and all that. But still, it does raise this question. Japan was trying to be imperialistic, and how they thought they'd get away with attacking the sleeping giant is amazing. And then and what you, the story you just tell confirms that as well. So it is this a new friend of mine. His name is Yoichi Shimatsu, and he's a former editor of the Japan Times Weekly, and he is a really interesting, knowledgeable fellow. And we've been corresponding, and he says, Japan is just a bureaucratic society, and that's the way. He uses some other funny words in for adjectives. Dumb, I think, was one, but it's this bureaucratic mentality of, well, we'll just deal with it one thing at a time. And then 50 years from now, when we're still trying to get the fuel out of the melted fuel out of the reactors, we'll have to deal with that then. But and so there isn't a cohesive plan to this Fukushima disaster. And Arnie and Helen Caldicott were talking and discussing this. And it's just this thing is going to go on for decades. And it's going to cost billions of dollars, and the whole time it's going to be contaminating the surrounding environment. We now can't believe a word TEPCO says, because TEPCO is the Tokyo Electric Power Company. That's the acronym. People probably have heard that,
Oh yes,
TEPCO anyway. And I tried to give them every benefit of the doubt, bend over backwards to say, well, I could easily criticize them, but okay, maybe what they're saying is 50% true or something. But with recent statements like this last one, I think their credibility is so low. We just don't know. We just can't believe anything they say anymore. It's the government isn't holding their feet to the fire, and the international community isn't. Also, is not the international nuclear establishment is part of the problem, because they're also in denial, and they don't want to delegitimize the global nuclear mafia because they're a part of it. And so they want to keep the scam going. And so it's just a really deep, it's a wide problem because it's global, and it's also deep because it's deep within the, bureaucratic mentality of the Japanese culture.
Right. Now, of course, the issue too is the health of the people in the country. And of course, the winds that bring the same kinds of the radiation over to this country and the fishing industry and all of the rest. I mean, that's a really big issue.
That's right. It's not only a Japanese issue, it's they're polluting the Pacific Ocean. When the reactors blew up, the fumes, the particles did travel to the United States and North America. And technically, there's a lot of scientific data that radiation went pretty much around the world or something. But I mean, for all intents and purposes, most of it remained either around Japan or in the ocean. It went and kind of dumped into the ocean. We're talking at 311, when most of the radiation was released during that time. But I think, quite, it was something like 0.2% of the radiation did reach the west coast of the US. And so, but it's ongoing as well. And then you have other people who are measuring. There's a guy, Michael Collins, who is often a guest on Rents. And he's in California, and he writes a lot about, he's testing foods. And like he was going around to sushi bars and saying, you know, how much radiation has increased in the various kinds of sushi and the delicacies they're serving, because people, it's very popular there, you know. So some people, not the mainstream media, are concerned and checking out the increasing amount of radiation as it contaminates the ocean. Most of the radiation went into the ocean, and so there you have the fish. The tuna were detected with radiation as far as California, and they assume that those tuna had picked up the radiation when they were swimming somewhere around Japan around the time of the accident. And of course, tuna are very wide-ranging and fast migrating fish, so they brought that radiation with them, and it indicates that the radiation is widespread in the Pacific Ocean. And if this radiation just keeps seeping into the groundwater, and even if it's kind of a small rate, it's still a constant rate. Perhaps a billion becquerels per day is being released by the plant, which is sounds like a lot. It's I mean, one becquerel is enough to cause cancer, I guess. So,
right.
But spread around the ocean, I guess it's not very much. But the idea that it's every day, and there's already a lot of, there's so much data now that fish, especially around Japan, local fish have a certain amount of cesium and other radioactive elements, and even above government standards. So the government in Japan is saying, well, if your fish is under 100 becquerels per kilogram, then don't worry, it's safe, you know, and that's another topic.
Yeah, so they just changed the standard for safety.
Yeah, and just to make it completely relative, you know, and if the National Academy of Sciences says that there is no known safe dose of radiation, so what's the reality is the big question. And yes, and they changed it, they raised the I think they actually, yeah, they fluctuated the standards, but I would say, you know, if it's, to me, if it has one becquerel, that's kind of scary if I'm eating that all the time, one becquerel per kilogram in anything. But I would say today in Japan, there's many foods that would have somewhere between one or 100 becquerels per kilogram if that food came from the Fukushima region, for example, or if it was fish. And so the idea that you'd be eating that normally, or that children who would be especially in danger could just be eating that, is like, well, I'm getting, and you're not eating a whole kilogram, but, you know, you're getting a few becquerels here and there. Just that idea alone just disturbs me, because that's on an ongoing kind of permanent basis.
Sure. Now, how has your family changed their eating habits since this happened?
I have been very concerned about that and try to buy food from Western Japan as much as possible. And I'm sorry for the people who grow food in those regions around Fukushima, but I do try not to buy anything from there if I can help it, vegetables or so on. But if, you know, if people go to restaurants, or if they buy anything in the store, and drinks, for example, the water in Tokyo has been detected with cesium well below one becquerel, according to the government, if you can believe the government. But, and so, you know, all of these drink products, like in Japan, they drink a lot of tea, you know, out of plastic bottles. We call them PET bottles. And I personally have had a hard time convincing my family about this. I've had some success, you know, to try to get people to be careful about what they consume. But a lot of people, my family and many people, I have this mentality of, we're kind of getting back to the kamikaze mentality. They have a saying in Japan, shogunai, which means there is nothing that can be done, you know, it's fate. And so, to try to battle against this, you know, indifference is really difficult and kind of frustrating sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. I think just about everybody that I know, when I talk to them about their family and how they what methods they use to disseminate what they know to their families, they tell me the same thing. And I know my own family. They really need this information, and some of the people in my family are very receptive, and others just aren't. And you just feel it's very frustrating. But I
Yeah,
don't
so
know.
well, thank you. That makes me feel a little better, actually, because, right, sometimes I feel isolated, but I know a lot of people have the same, these same social patterns of whether it's radiation or GMOs or whatever, or vaccinations. People are in denial about the effects because the establishment is telling them that it's safe and wonderful, and the propaganda is effective to at least make people, even if they don't fully believe it, they're not worried enough to fight against it.
Right. Well, we've all been indoctrinated to believe those authority figures in our lives, and we hear the repetition on television. And I think too that most people would never, never dream of hurting anyone else, strangers or nobody. They would never think of hurting another human being, because I think that humans are basically good. And so they just cannot conceive that there would be people out there that really lie to them and really make a profit by harming other people.
Yes, exactly.
So I guess you have to be
Exactly. And I know
psychopathic.
you've talked about that. Welcome to Obama world.
Yes.
No, I mean, I know. Well, for one thing, I support all, maybe not every word, but I support all of your other guests, wholeheartedly. And I know the focus of your work, and I try to promote that sometimes in my articles about the wider political and global Zionism and things like that, although that's not directly connected to the Fukushima thing. But just as a kind of digression, if you don't mind, my next two projects are, and I'm going to announce it to the world right now, I'm going to write a book review of Where Did the Towers Go by Judy Wood. And
Oh,
so
wonderful.
I'm really excited about that, and I'm reading it, and it's fantastic. And the other book you might have heard of, it's called The Zionist Seizure of World Power. And
Yes, I've heard of that.
I'm gonna write, and when I say something like this, I don't just, it's not empty words. So I have written one, anyway, the book Zionist Seizure is by Deanna Spingola, in case anybody doesn't know that. So
I rarely ever say anything about my own stuff.
yeah, well, no, and so I heard you on Texmars, and that was a good interview too.
Oh, yeah.
So actually, he sent me the wrong book, and I said, "You sent
What
the
happened?
wrong book." So they sent me the other one for
Oh,
free, so
good.
I got lucky that day. But so I got the price of one. I have written one of, yeah, very clever of me. The other book review
You've
wrote was
kind
Eric
of cutting
Wahlberg's book
out.
about and it was Zionism. And oh, sorry, hello.
Yeah, okay. You're kind of cutting out a little bit.
Yeah, you were too. That's a Skype thing, huh?
Yeah, I think so.
I'll kind of go back. Well, I told you I'm writing the book reviews, and I just wanted to mention that. And so I just wanted to put that in there so
It's kind of. Oh, I'm sorry.
people can read my articles at Activist Post or Rents or various places.
It's kind of interesting that just for the anniversary, that one of the PBS stations have a let's see, an explosive. What was the name of it?
Yeah,
They just
that's
came out
right.
with it. It starts out with Richard Gage, and it's a nice movie, but it certainly does not say anything about Dr. Wood's research. And I think that. That's why they're coming out with it in more public places, because I think her work has such an impact in
Yeah.
the truth movement that they have to focus on what the opposition is saying. And you hate to say opposition when you're talking about 9/11 and people trying to get the truth out, but
Right.
some of the people aren't. Some of the people are trying to conceal the truth. Because what she says about the implications for directed energy weapons and directed energy is pretty influential and pretty significant. So, of course, they don't want that to be creeping out there.
Yeah. Oh, it is so interesting. And yeah, and it's amazing now that these 9/11 so-called truth movement is becoming mainstream like that, which makes you wonder about how much of the truth they're telling. Exactly. And I've corresponded with Judy and I'm reading her book, and the evidence, I've never seen the evidence presented so clearly and in such a, you know, irrefutable way with the logic and the explanations and the photographs as she has done it. And, you know, the rest of the 9/11 truth movement has definitely added a lot of really important information, and they brought down the veil. You know, they've exposed the lies to a great extent, but they haven't taken it all the way like she has. And I don't understand why they're blocking her evidence. That's very strange.
Well, the implication of free energy. And when you think about the fact that Tesla's work and research would have allowed everyone in the world to have access to free energy, because it is, you know, part of the environment. It's part of, you know, it's part of our environment. And yet we have all of these companies. Well, you mentioned TEPCO. We have all of these companies that have harnessed something that should be free to everybody. All these companies have harnessed this energy and are charging the world for it. I mean, charging yeah. people for something that is free. So the implications of that are very significant.
I see that if you take it to that level, that could be the reason that she is being blocked. Her you know, top-notch scientific research, and they're trying to discredit her in every other way, character assassination, hit pieces throughout the alternative media or whatever.
Yes, and you wonder.
So that's the reason. Yeah, I didn't realize that.
And when you look at some of the people who are doing that, you think, well, yeah. Gosh, what? Who did they work for anyway?
Yeah, I won't name any names, but
no, we won't go there.
I know what you mean. I know personally. I was on a radio show like this once, and it had kind of an odd experience. But now I'm on Rentz's show quite often, and he's really gracious and great host, and he's supported my work, and I appreciate that, and he's really championed the Fukushima issue, and so I appreciate that. But on the 9/11 issue, it is odd that the alternative media is reacting the way it is like that, so it could be the Tesla thing. And the other thing with the nukes is, it's not only they have a monopoly over our energy supply so they can charge us money, but they've even admitted, and this is well known pretty much, that nuclear power is just a cover for nuclear weapons. And so you have all these third world countries that want to get a nuclear power plant because it's so high tech and it'll lead us into the future. And in the meantime, the standard of living in Somalia or whatever is, you know, like $1 a week or something.
Right.
And so it's absurd. There's a really good book called The Doomsday Machine by Cohen and MacKillop. And it's an excellent anti-nuclear handbook. I recommend it to everybody. It's very readable, short and readable, and fact-filled. But their argument is that the overall nuclear power plants are a pretext for nuclear weapons development. And then in Japan, you have these right-wing or far-right fanatics, psychopaths saying, well, really, we need nuclear power because for security, just in case we get attacked by Korea, we can nuke them back or something. So they admitted, and what happened is very interesting. The government in Japan had an online poll where they asked people, they gave them three options. You want to have nuclear power 100% to the level that we had it before, or do you want it to have it 50% to the level that we had it before, or do you want zero nuclear power? And 90% of the people who voted on this poll, and I think there was they got quite a substantial sampling of the population, 90% wanted the zero option. They want to abolish nuclear power in Japan. And I think that is the overall sentiment. Without doubt, if you ask the average Japanese person, they would be very anti-nuke, more or less, in many cases, you know, strongly anti-nuke. And so the prime minister of Japan, because he's just a puppet of the nuclear mafia, he said, well, we're going to go for the middle option because the people that voted don't really count or something.
Isn't that true about everything, anywhere?
That's true about the Democratic and Republican conventions, I heard, yeah. Where they voted, where they used teleprompters to tell them what the vote is, yeah.
Right. And they changed the rules, and yeah. Oh my goodness, and who picked these people for us to vote for to begin with? I mean,
yeah. So you're right about that. The energy issue really gets to the core, and it gets to the core issues of democracy and autonomy and libertarian principles, or just basic communitarian principles of controlling your own life and your own community. Mm-hmm. And yet these states, and it's an old problem that goes back centuries, of states gaining power. And the more power that states, means nation states, gain, the more abusive they become in general. It's a slippery slope.
Right. And of course, how better to control people than to control their energy? And I mean, think about it, your electricity, everything. I mean, what would happen if all of a sudden you lost your power, and that was it, and they can control you very well with that, and of course they make a lot of money, and when you look back at the early, whether you're talking transportation, whether you're talking electricity, water, I mean that's all pretty important, and when the elite control all of that, which they have now in corporations, it's pretty significant. And so her book, when you think about what she is saying, well,
profound.
Profound.
Very, very profound. You're right. And yes, I haven't read the whole thing yet. But I'm going to. And I'm a slow reader, but I'm careful because I don't like to be hoodwinked. So I check the details as I go. And
sure. And her book is not like a novel. I mean, it needs to be studied. And it is an interesting book. I have so many Post-it notes on pages because I should actually own stock in Post-it note company, but because I
see,
do that a lot when I read.
You become an elite, too.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it is just interesting training your mind scientifically to think scientifically. In her book, is if I had more time, I'd love to study more science issues. But I guess studying the nuclear issue and then 9/11 are two areas that it keeps your mind sharp to think like that, to look at evidence. And she mentions in her book, you know, if you had a high school physics class, that you would have seen how, you know, one object hitting another and what the reaction is and so on. And it made me think back to our education system. And I never caught on to algebra and the math very well. And so, but when I got into a physics class in high school, where it was explained just to the layperson, not to the person who was going to go on and do the calculations, it was so interesting to me. And so that's the same thing I think it's a shame that more people aren't interested in understanding how things work like this. And if they had this book in front of them and examined the evidence, they would see that the official story is just totally absurd. I mean, right in the first chapter where she debunks the collapse, that is impossible. It goes against the laws of Newton. Have they invented new Newtonian laws? I guess the U.S. government has, because no physicist have pointed out this basic thing, that the building couldn't have collapsed according to all the official explanations.
Right. But of course, I think the public the public is so dumbed down, and they will believe what they hear rather than what they see. And that's her strength, is that she doesn't deviate. She looks completely at the scientific evidence, and she doesn't just make assumptions. She proves her evidence. She presents it so logically.
Yeah.
And when you try and get her to veer off course, she will just say no. I mean, she is straight on. She just does not veer off.
Yeah, she's a tough cookie.
She is. She really is.
She's good. Yeah, I know her now. We email, but what was I gonna say? That's funny. But yeah, it's just a great book, and the evidence speaks for itself. You said the people are dumbed down. Oh yeah, when I saw this book, I felt that I was dumb before I read this. It was like I had this moment where I thought, where you have a realization, and I thought, oh my God, have you ever had that where you didn't know something and suddenly you discover something and you think you're kind of ashamed, like, wow, was I stupid? I didn't realize this. But that's like every day of life. If you're open to learning new things in life, you're always discovering new things. But
right.
The book was so enlightening. I just felt like, oh my gosh, I believed all that other nonsense before, and now I understand.
Well, look at all the other stuff that we've been led to believe. I mean, even about vaccines. This one of my guests this week, Mary Toko, said, well, if you're talking to somebody that really doesn't want to trust what you're saying about the dangers of vaccines, just say, okay, if you had an apple and if you injected thimerosal, mercury, cow pus, aborted fetal tissue, and then several other things, the things that they put in vaccine, and if you inject all of those into that apple, would you want to eat it? Well, of course not. And yet that's what we allow them to inject in our bodies. What are we thinking? Are we just plain stupid or just so trusting and so naive? And they play upon our naivety.
That's a great analogy she has. Yeah, Mary Toko, I've heard her. Very, very good show she has. That's a great analogy. And that you could use that for a lot of the other things we put in our body, the food, the processed food and fake food and everything.
Yeah.
Radioactive food. And people are led to believe that small amounts of this or that aren't going to really harm you, but it's
cumulative. Yeah.
Oh, very good. Yeah. I'm glad you covered the vaccine issue. That was another topic I struggled with when I was raising my kids. And actually, my wife did agree, and we had a lot less vaccines than we could have had. So I think they had some of the basic ones, but the school kept advertising, you need to bring your kid in. They don't force you to do it here yet. and so that was a battle we kind of won, where I did convince that we should make, perhaps, you know, instead of getting, and you know, the other one is the flu vaccine. You can fight that with vitamin D and vitamin C and healthy lifestyle.
Sure.
And there's still pump. That's the big one that comes around every year. You know, did you get your flu shot? And boy, that's totally unnecessary. I mean.
Oh, absolutely. Well, let's get back to this Fukushima thing. You mentioned Chernobyl, and that this is the second Chernobyl. And I was reading on a website that there are now a lot of animals who seem to be thriving in that area.
Okay. In Chernobyl? Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thriving. Yeah. They're coming back. And so you mean that it's the area's recovered?
I don't know. I'm not sure. You know, that I don't know that would indicate that it's recovering but right. There's a lot of wolves and things like that seem to be doing well. They're not they don't have two heads and seven legs or anything. But
right. No, you know, that is that's interesting. There has been a lot of scientific biological data research about genetic mutations and those kind of things that have happened in Chernobyl and even in Fukushima now. A few weeks ago, there was a kind of big story about mutated butterflies in Fukushima. And so the idea is that that's an indication of what could be coming for people living in that region because, of course, they have much shorter generations. They evolve much quicker. And so if these genetic mutations are passed on to the next generation, human beings in the genomic structure of organisms, including human beings, will be altered into the future. It's an experiment. But, of course, Chernobyl is the place to look for what to expect because that's happened 25 or more years ago. So that is a good... I saw one a documentary, Carl Grossman, who's been involved in the nuclear issue for years, called Environmental Video or something is his website. And he interviewed a professor who studied Chernobyl, and their findings were that generation by generation, many of the organisms in Chernobyl were actually dying off. In other words, each subsequent generation of insects and so on were getting weaker and less productive. So that's just one piece of data, but that is a really big question. How is this radiation going to affect future generations of people? And the other thing is, recently there was an environmental group in Fukushima or in Japan that warned, and this made kind of a big stir, they warned that people from Fukushima shouldn't marry because their children run the risk of having a birth defect, you know. And so this created a huge stir, and the establishment fought back and said, you know, yeah, you can't say that, and it's prejudiced and everything. So it really raises these thorny questions about, and you have to ask, gee, if I was a young Japanese person and I met somebody from, I met a young girl from Fukushima, I mean, you know, of course it seems impolite, but you worry, gee, is that going to have an effect on if we have children in the future, you know? So,
right.
So sad. Uncertainty is the real factor.
They say that if you do certain things, take certain supplements and boost your immune system, that this won't affect you as badly. Now, is there something that the government there or the health practitioners, I don't know, that they manage sickness.
That's a contradiction, right?
Yes. That they are recommending that people take, such as iodine or something like that. But then the Japanese normally ingest a lot of iodine-containing things that, for instance, Japanese women don't have as much breast cancer. Would that be a factor in perhaps boosting the immune system over there so that it wouldn't do the damage that it would for instance, to somebody in the Middle East or in the Midwest here?
Yes, that's a very good, interesting question because that's right. Number one, I have heard and read a lot about the different ways that you can reduce the effects of the radiation. And so there was a really good website up, but somebody attacked and took it down. But there is, if you look around, I mean, just things like turmeric is supposed to help to clean up, you know, so there's all the detox things that you can do. And I think if people go on the internet and take very careful study, they can find a number of supplements that would help. And I've done that too, and I take a lot of those supplements. But and I would take a lot of those supplements anyway, just for general health reasons or whatever. But that's right. The iodine in kombu, which is kelp, is very commonly consumed in soup here, miso soup, and in other there's also seaweed product in. That are just eaten along with rice and things like that. And so there is sometimes I get the types of seaweed mixed up, but there's kelp, which is quite different from laver, which is the seaweed. And so if you go to a sushi restaurant, that's where they wrap it in seaweed. That's one kind of thing. But the other one that has the iodine is kelp, and that's not eaten raw necessarily, but it's cooked or something, and you ingest it that way. But it's very good for iodine, so that would be the reason. Traditionally, Japanese have had lower cancer rates, and women have lived longer here, or women had very long lifespans, and they thought the reasons for that would be, diet and things like that. But, of course, then we come to the next problem, which is that if the ocean has been contaminated with radiation, then and they're ingesting, so you have, it's canceling out the effect. If it's radioactive kelp, so that's the worry again. They've spoiled the nest, you know. So, but any way that you can find, I'm just very careful if I shop for something. I try to find healthy food from regions that I think are, you know, radiation free. But when you're talking about the ocean, then it's really tricky because all of the seaweed and things come from the ocean, and the ocean around Japan now has definitely been affected. So, and the seaweed absorbs, it's kind of a sponge or a filter for the water. So somebody said that, and I wonder, you know, how radioactive it could be. Yoichi Shimatsu did a study about the fish, because it's very interesting. The fisher people, mostly men probably, in the Fukushima region were trying to gather data to compare with TEPCO's data, because TEPCO is saying, well, the ocean's not very polluted, it's really clean, we didn't spill any. And so they're saying, you know, the fish are fine, and the fishermen themselves are trying to come up with data so that they can get economic, monetary compensation from TEPCO, saying, hold on a minute, you've polluted the ocean, look at the fish we're catching, they have radiation, you should compensate us, you know, you should pay us. Yeah, and so there is a lot of research into how contaminated the fish in the area are, that people seriously want to know the truth, and whether the government and TEPCO can be relied on for their data, whether it's accurate or not, is a question. I mean, it's probably relatively accurate, but there's definitely a lot of radiation in the ocean around Japan, and I steer clear of fish for the most part, which is too bad.
Right. Now, have you personally tested the radioactivity level in the ocean?
I have a simple kind of, not that cheap actually, but it's one of those gamma, a standard dosimeter, and it's very good for looking for hot spots, but it's not, I haven't tested, you know, to do actual testing of foods or of substances is a quite a complicated, I think you need a really sophisticated machine to do that. So, although the guy, Michael Collins, he has a different kind of machine, and he seems to be publishing some data on that, on substances and food. So I'm not sure about that. But there's a good website called securitytokyo.com, and they randomly checks products, and I think they're honest, you know. And so it'll say, like, pecans in California has 2 becquerels or something, and you wonder, how did pecans in California, or almonds, I'm sorry, how did almonds in California get radiation, you wonder. And then other things in Japan, one thing I noticed is that most of the products they checked around Japan, Tokyo or Fukushima, have some radiation, whereas Western Japan, they wouldn't have any radiation. So, you know, whether it's watermelon or raspberries or something like that.
Right. Well, it's just interesting to me, in comparing this to the BP oil spill. I know that they had actors that were involved in the in some of the video that they shot at the BP oil spill, and I know that they kept showing the very, very same very, very grainy, unclear, underwater video for several days. And we know that we cannot trust the government for their information.
Yeah.
And the government is very complicit with the media. So I'm always very skeptical about anything that I hear. I mean, if they lie about one thing, they're going to lie about another thing. And my contention has always been, why would these people, whoever these people are, that are doing these things, why would they spoil their own environment? Because they have to live on this planet too. And of course, I know about all the underground cities that they supposedly have. But, you know, they on the one hand, they talk about being environmentally conscious wanting to have wilderness areas. And then on the other hand, they tell us they're pouring corrects into the ocean.
Yeah. That's a very good point. We're all spoiling our own nest. On two points. Number one, on the reliability of information, that's kind of what I've tried to do in my articles from the beginning of the Fukushima thing, is just to evaluate the data that comes out in a kind of a thoughtful way and say, okay, they're saying this. And of course, you should always take whatever the government or some authority says with a grain of salt, but then you can compare it with what other independent researchers say. And that's been my kind of investigation of the Fukushima thing. And it's just, it's an unraveling tale of lies, I think. Just taking them on their word, they just contradict themselves all the time. Just like with, I think in the case of BP, it was so blatant. It was just really outrageous. I mean, the U.S. is just such an outrageously criminalized government. Compared
right.
to even Japan. Japan's actually pretty good compared. But the nuclear thing has really blown the lid off Japan, though. I mean, they were supposedly the Japanese, you know, superior, and it turns out not to be true. On the other issue of spoiling their nest, I mean, I agree with you there. I mean, I think I go back to somebody like Mark Glenn or Michael Collins Piper who say, and they're talking about the Zionists, but it's not only the Zionists, of course, but that these people just go too far. You know, they have no, nothing's going to satisfy them. It's pathology. I mean, they're willing to destroy themselves to, you know, it's the Samson option, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to win no matter what, even if we have to all destroy ourselves. And it's combined with this technological, technocentric mentality of scientists and techno geeks who believe in, and this has nothing to do with ethnicity or, you know, Zionism or anything. It's kind of another paradigm, but people whose academic background is in an area where they're very certain about science. It's called scientism, I guess. People who believe science is, you know, a religion. And then in my latest article, I point out that some scientists came up with this idea of taking the nuclear waste and putting it on an elevator up to outer space, shooting the nuclear waste into the sun. And they actually say it'll be safe and won't affect the Earth's environment. And they're being serious, you know. This is a paper written by some techno geeks in the, who get funding in the European Union or somewhere like this. And so this is, you know, this is the other problem, is this mentality of technology versus nature. And so there's all these different paradigms, and we're really, and it's all collapsing around us. I think there's so many infrastructure in disrepair, and the economic system is exposed and collapsing. And as the economy collapses, then the infrastructure can't be maintained. And when you're talking about nuclear power, that's really dangerous, because you have to guard the waste and everything. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, there's just a lot of things to think about. And
I enjoyed talking so much. Thank you today. So.
Well, I really enjoy chatting with you. It's wonderful. And I really appreciate your articles. And the latest one is from 9/5/12 at Rents.
Yeah, it was. It's posted at Rents and an activist post and the Intel Hub. It's called "Doomed Planet for a Failed Species?" Question, the Fukushima tragedy, and so it's. I'm getting some traction. My article before that was about the workers, the nuclear workers, and how the Japanese mafia are so deeply involved in the whole nuclear industry, and that's another just crazy question. It's like, how could you put these a bunch of criminals, they admit they're criminals, and they're practically running the nuclear power stations.
Yeah,
and
that's a Yakuza?
Yes, the Yakuza. And, you know, some of them are very honorable individuals, the workers who are sacrificing their lives and everything. It's a very sad situation for some of them. But, of course, the criminal network itself is very evil and exploitative. And they're going to be bringing in, as they run out of workers, they're going to be bringing in workers from other countries because the workers are reaching the level of exposure, radiation exposure, that they can't legally exceed, whether they'll follow the rules or not. And so they'll bring workers from other third world countries, I guess. They'll sneak them in, but that's not going to be a very good solution.
No. My word. And it says in your article, you say that 30% of the 1,495 workers at the site suffer from severe mental health issues.
Yeah. I mean, just living in Tokyo is, I mean, I think most of us have the same problem. Can you imagine working in Fukushima? It's just, I can't imagine the stress. The article goes into all the details of the horrendous conditions, you know, the inhuman conditions. It's the heat, and they can't go to the bathroom, and they're exposed to radiation, and they're threatened by the Yakuza bosses. You know, if you don't do the work, there could be violence involved. Just, it really gets down to the brutal. A lot of the credit for that research goes to a guy named Jake Adelstein, who is a really interesting reporter in Japan who's written about the underworld, the Japanese underworld and the Yakuza. And he's just a young guy, really, but he's done really good research. So I quote from him, but there's a lot of other Japanese undercover journalists and so on that exposed that issue. But
now, how many of those almost 1,500 people that work there have died?
Yes, that's the other. Sometimes these statistics, I think it's in the article there, but it's kind of a mystery, you know. Yeah, people have died, like they die of heart attacks and so on. And then TEPCO says, well, it was unrelated to the radiation, of course, you know. We had nothing to do with it. And so it's very hard to say exactly. But, you know, the nuclear industry says nobody's died from Fukushima, you know. That didn't kill anybody. So it shows how safe nuclear energy is. But in reality, I mean, there's all these stress factors, and even the Japanese news admitted that 500 people, and everything I'm saying is cited in my article somewhere. That's why I'm kind of able to just recite it back to you. But so if you go back and check through them, but I think over 500 people were said to have died from, related to the Fukushima nuclear disaster, you know, from stress or not necessarily from radiation, but there's no question that the amount of radiation there, the workers are exposed to is, you know, dangerous. And so it's, now Arne Gundersen says, if what they'll end up having to do is to pour concrete over those reactors in maybe 5 or 10 years from now, because they'll still be so hot, it'll be impossible to send workers in there to do anything. And so then you'd be saying, you know, suicide missions for the workers, and how they could get away with that would be a really big question, because that would just be a scandal if they were to force the workers to go in there.
Oh,
so if
yeah.
They have, yeah. And so this is to kind of wrap up this topic. This is what they'd have to do is, and this is very controversial because, and I'm not an engineer, and all of us lay people are relying on experts for their opinions because we don't understand these issues as we need to. So They would pour concrete over the three reactors that are so hot where the fuel is melted down, and then they would have to monitor those reactors for hundreds of years, and they would have to bore holes up underneath the reactors to suck out the radioactive water so that it doesn't go into the ocean or the groundwater. And the point of this is that's so amazing is that it would have to go on for hundreds of years to prevent the leakage and the contamination of the surrounding area. And yet they have all this contaminated water that they're storing at the site, which is cooling the fuel, the melted fuel, right? And so they pump in the water, then they pump it out, and they have to store it, and it's radioactive. And they have all these containers all over the place.
Yeah, so how's that going to go on indefinitely?
Yeah, for hundreds of years. And it's going to cost $500 billion, you know. And the Japanese people will have to pay this $500 billion. And Japan is, it's a shrinking society demographically, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, I don't think, except that you have this huge economic burden. And how are they going to pay for these things, you know, for hundreds of years into the future? And it's just, as you said at the beginning of the program, these assumptions made like, well, we'll deal with this and then tomorrow we'll deal with the next problem. But there's no vision or, you know, sanity to any of it.
Right. That reminds me of Scarlett O'Hara.
Oh.
Remember that movie?
Yeah. But
Gone with the Wind.
Sorry?
Yeah, remember that movie, Gone with the Wind, and she's, yeah. You know, she's always saying, oh, we'll worry about that tomorrow.
Oh, I see. Right, she was under a lot of pressure because of that.
Right. Yeah.
Yes. Well, frankly, I couldn't give a damn.
Okay.
Sorry,
Rhett
I
Butler.
I didn't mean that about your program.
Yes, Rhett Butler.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it's been very nice talking with you, and I hope that we can do this again. And I wish the best for you and your family. And of course, I think all of us worry about the people in Japan. And that's first, your family is the first people that I thought about when this occurred. And
I remember you sent an email. Thank you. Yeah. Actually, this is a strange story. When the earthquake happened, I was taking a nap in the afternoon, and I was listening to the Rick Adams show, and you and he were discussing things. So I don't know what that means, but
yeah, interesting.
I don't blame you, Deanna.
Okay.
But I hope that the information I explained was understandable, and that the audience will appreciate that. And I don't know what to tell people other than if they can, you know, not just forget about this issue and put pressure on the government to get this issue solved. There has to be international pressure. So,
sure.
But I know there's so many problems that how are people in America going to worry about that when they have all of the other issues to deal with? I know, but hopefully just getting the information out is one thing I can do.
Yes, and if people will go to your articles and read them, and I will link them on my radio schedule page. And yes, read those articles, and so that we'll all be informed and know what's going on. And we can't be isolated in this. We do need to think about other people, even people in other countries, because if it can happen there, it can happen here, and so we need to stand together.
Well, and it's the Pacific Ocean as well. I mean, that's a pretty big puddle that could become contaminated for eternities. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Take care.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye-bye.